Hello and welcome to The Rolling Ball, the Leicester Tigers fans podcast, which is reading from the hymn sheet of being gracious victors and offers to sup from the shared cup of good sportsmanship with our good friends, the Harlequins podcast. And with that in mind, we say, get some of that down here, you soft southern posh boys. Was that a little too far?
No, not at all.
No, not at all. Did you hear their intro?
I did. That was quite punchy, I thought. I thought that was a...
the chubby cheap shot. Yeah, chubby Midland smile. I mean, all right. We can't all be oil paintings, lads. Although, let me say, I was a looker, 10 years ago, but admittedly a decade of sticking my head into rucks, having kids, and admittedly a little bit of the overindulgence in the Apres match may have led to this disheveled failure that you see before you now. But there we go. They are great lads. It is all good chat and all above board, so no offence taken, you wankers. But yes, we'll be pulling apart Sunday's victory over the reigning champions Harlequins before we'll be looking at some of the likely lads for Elliot's Colt Corner in the fly half slot before descending into the obscure realm of the inside centre. Nobody knows really what they do. Hopefully we'll find out in Colt Corner. Then after that, we will be having a look ahead to the Bordeaux game. Now, I do quite like a glass of Bordeaux. Don't know if I like a full glass of Frenchman, but that's what we've got this weekend. But lots to look forward to. Elliot, how was your weekend, mate? Did you enjoy the game? We had our rendezvous finally.
We did indeed. It was a good weekend. And then the game itself, which was really good. And yes, we did meet for the first time. There was no catfishing involved. You wore your white carnation on your jacket so I could see who you were. It was all, it's like blind date.
It was. I mean, admittedly, I don't think either of us would be particularly delighted if we were on blind dates and the other one would have appeared. But, you take what you get. Beggars can't be choosers. That said, I did notice that we were terribly thirsty. A lot of people said that if they saw us, they'd buy us a beer. And either maybe it's because we were getting on well and nobody wanted to interrupt. But my thirst remained unquenched in that pub whilst we were waiting. So if you were there, next time, forcefully give me beer and I'll be very much obliged.
Absolutely. But to be fair, you did buy me a drink. So thank you very much.
I now owe you.
Yeah, put it on the tab. Put it on the tab, mate.
Yeah, it's been noted. It's fine. Interest is accruing. have we got anyone to say hello to, Elliot, before we get going?
We do. There's a few shout outs from Twitter. So in no particular order, I will run through them. So thank you very much for getting in touch with us. As always, it is always much appreciated. Simon Armstrong, Ann Dawkins, James Rudman and Russell Allen. Thank you very much for getting in touch with us.
Yeah, I'm going to say thank you to Calvin Boyd for the ticket. I put a shout out. I basically abused the power of the podcast and said, does anyone have a standing ticket for Sunday? And Calvin, unfortunately, couldn't make it, but very kindly offered to sell me his tickets at fair price. So thank you, Calvin. I had a fantastic time at your expense, but I hope everything is well with you and I really appreciate you looking out for me. Thanks also to Mick Bannister for offering his tickets. I hope everything, as always, is going well with your recovery. And also, special thanks to John Toogood, who helped basically put my vision onto the internet of having the Ben Youngs or Marcus Smith handoff immortalised with the background music from Simon and Garfunkel's Hello Darkness, well, Sound of Silence, but the Hello Darkness, My Old Friend bar. And he put that together very quickly and immaculately. So thank you, John, for that. As always, if you've got anything that you want to get in touch with us about, please do tweet us at Rolling Mall Pod on Twitter or email at therollingmall@outlook.com. All right, now, firstly, apologies if this all seems a little bit cobbled together tonight because we are doing this at gone 10 o'clock on Monday night. This is due to me having to trawl back from Leicester to the West Country, which anyone who's done the M5 at any time past 8 o'clock knows is a nightmare. They close lanes at a whim, seemingly just to wind me up. That seems to be Highways England, the entire objective at the moment is to wind me up. So thank you very much for that. So we're doing this very late. With no agenda, and again, apologies if it sounds a little bit rushed, but one thing we do have to talk about, and I know that you're willing to prattle off many excuses under the sun, Elliot, transfer talk, Andre Pollard, guaranteed to be coming in. You guaranteed it to be Wednesday or Thursday last week.
Sign,
seal of approval. Elliot, where is he, mate?
Well, he's in here. He's here, mate. He's with me. I tell the club when to announce it. So he's here having a beer with me, telling me when he's going to sign. No, in all fairness, for those that didn't know or hadn't noticed, the last week or so, both the podcast and myself went a little bit viral after last week's episode. So last week I had had it on two different sources that Pollard was a done deal. I said that in last week's podcast. So that was Monday. Tuesday, Bobby Bridge, who listens to us. So evening, morning, afternoon, Bobby, if you're listening, thanks for listening. Put it in the Mercury, saying basically quoted me verbatim almost. And then Wednesday, we went pretty viral as then that article, and I felt sorry for Bobby here because every journalist and media outlet and sports website in South Africa basically wrote verbatim what Bobby had wrote and basically copy and pasted all of Bobby's words into their own articles, which I thought was slightly unfair. It did remind me of my maths GCSE where we all basically turned in the same bit of coursework and all got A stars. Plagiarism, absolute plagiarism at its finest. But yeah, so effectively all the words that I'd said last week ended up all over the South African sports media. We then ended up going through Argentinian sports media, French sports media, and some fairly hefty rugby accounts latched onto it. And basically the rugby world at that point, so Planet Rugby, Rugby Pass, and a couple of others basically used the words that I had said, which made Wednesday afternoon fairly entertaining, if nothing else, with a slight bit of nerves.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, once you put yourself out there like that and suddenly every man and his dog is quoting your name and your words like that, it does make it a quite pressurised situation. And then, thankfully, the Times and then BBC Leicester also put a tweet out and some basically saying exactly what we had heard from their own sources. So, but from what I can see, I'm still confident in what we said last week. I still think Pollard is a done deal. I think the fact that Alex Lowe at the Times put his name to it, didn't use any of our words. So I presume he's probably got his own sources. I'd imagine the guys at BBC Leicester, so Chris and Adam, they've also probably have had it from at least two sources. So, you know, the reality is there's probably two, three, maybe four sources out there that have given this story out. So therefore, I think we can be pretty confident that Pollard is joining.
So it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Perhaps there are points around, you know, for example, whether it's accommodation or visas. Basically, the deal is done in principle, but it's just some of the fluff around it that needs to be ironed out. And if we know the club like we do, they don't want anything to go wrong at all. They want to get everything sealed off before they announce it.
100%. And to be fair, part of me does wonder, because it did go, you know, it became the story, I guess, on Wednesday or Thursday. Maybe they just pulled it just to take a bit of heat out of it. We've obviously got a couple of big
just,
games coming
you
up.
You say just to mug you off?
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that, but we all know Bondi has mugged me off there. We probably got the timing a bit wrong. So it did make me a bit nervous. I obviously don't want to let you, Mike, down. I don't want to let the podcast good name down. I mean, I'm not sure how we can drag it down any further, but I don't want
you're starting from a low base, mate. We'll be all right. Don't worry. Yeah, the good thing is that at the moment we're 0 from 1 on transfer rumours, but we can turn that around. It'll be 1 from 1, I'm sure, by the end.
Well, if he signs in the next couple of weeks, we can just claim it as ours. But it was quite funny that technically for a 24-hour period, we were...
You were a named source.
Yes.
This is it. This is the dream now. You're like an officially recognised journalist. I'm just the mug. I'm like some sort of like Jim Davidson on the show. Why did I pick Jim Davidson? Fuck's sake. Never mind. Anyway, look, that's enough of Pollard. Let's go and have a look at other transfer rumors. And I would classify as an even uglier one has reared its head, which is suggesting...
Nothing from us to do. We should clarify this didn't come from us. Nothing to do with us.
Think ugly, you automatically think us. But no, this one isn't from us. This is from the rugby paper. To be fair, they're not saying it's... There's conversations, they're saying that there's somebody interested, but the rumour is because Genge hasn't signed a contract extension yet or a new contract that Saracens are sniffing around. Now, you only have to look at the logistics of it. See, it makes sense for that conversation to happen. The rumour is Mako Vunipola might well be off because he seems to be out of the England reckoning and Jones doesn't want anything to do with him anymore. So if he's off to France or to Japan or wherever it may be to go and pick up a big paycheck, as he probably should do if Jones isn't looking at him, then Genge will undoubtedly be one of the players they're looking at. He will fit the bill. He'll probably be a like-for-like replacement. Obviously, from our point of view, we hope that is that complete and utter horseshit. And if we're going to talk about someone who you throw the checkbook at, I think it's Genge. He's the club captain. He's in, represents a lot of what is good about the club now in terms of its attitude and how we hold ourselves. even more so than Fordy. And, you know, particularly in the forwards, that's someone who, you know, we want to hang on to more than anything. So hopefully it is just a bit of, as any agent is, you know, worth their salt will do, will say, well, hang on, Saracens are going to be looking. Are you sure you don't want to go and up that by another few 10K? Maybe it's something to do with that. Maybe it isn't. Maybe they're just waiting to see what offers are out there, because Saracens look like a, you know, hell of a force again. They get 1/5 of the crowds we do. So they're never going to be as big a club, but they're still going to be an attractive proposition playing with the likes of Itoje and Daly, etc., week in, week out. So hopefully it's nonsense, but we'll wait and see. What's your view on it?
It's all. I agree with you. I think we all hope it's nonsense, and I'd like to think it is. I think the other part in play is that when it comes to all these transfer rumours, there is numerous parts of in play, and this is all a big dance between clubs, agents and players. You also have to remember here, Saris have been also been with Urbano down at Bath, which I think is probably the more likely signing. So this rumour may
is he Itoje's cousin as well, isn't he?
I think so, yeah. There is a link he there, is. I think. But, you know, the rumours of Urbano from a couple of months ago was going to Saris. You know, this may ultimately, this rumour may have come to from Saris to, I think, Neil Fizzler at the rugby paper, almost to force Urbano's hands, just to say, look, we've got other options. So if you take your time or stick us around, we've got other options in play. So take the contract we've put on the table for you. So look, there's a lot of dancing going on. There's a lot of people getting their agendas out, and we'll use a bit of media briefing and slip some sources out for their own agendas and for their own prerogatives. Do I think Mako is off? Yes. Do I think Saris are interested in Genji? Why wouldn't you? He's brilliant and he's awesome. Yeah. Do I think Genji will ultimately go to Saris? Ultimately, no. I think the fact he's club captain here, I think that's a big thing, irrespective of, you know, the wage thing or whatever. My point is this, I've said this before, top two teams in the league this season are us and Saris. That's my opinion. You're club captain at one of those two. Things are going good. You know, but Steve's going to be with us the next couple of years up to the World Cup. I just can't see Genji jumping ship. Even if there is more money on the table, I think you've got an equal chance of getting some trophies with us. So I suspect there's some games at play. I ultimately expect Genji to sign a new contract with us and Urbano to sign with Saris.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? Because I would say that the difference between this and the Ford situation is that if you listen to Ford's reasoning, and he gave a really interesting and honest interview with BBC Sports afterwards, where he, after the game on Sunday, where he assured everyone that, you know, he's going to be giving his all for the club whilst he's still here. But he also said that actually this whole thing about him playing up north is actually very much a soul pull for him. He wants to play effectively where he feels like his soul belongs, which is, it sounds a bit corny, but I can get my head around that. And it's also, he alluded to the fact that, you know, look, his family's there and he's got business interests there. And, you know, this is a guy probably wanting to settle down, and it makes sense. Now, we can say, well, hang on, you know, what's 3 years, you know, in the professional rugby's lifespan? You know, you could spend that at Leicester and then do that in 3 years' time. But, you know, we don't know his fucking conditions or, you know, what's going through his mind or what stresses he's under on the personal front. So, you know, fuck it. But the thing was, the ball wasn't in our court with that. I feel with Genji, the ball is in our court, as opposed to with Saracens. The reason being is, I think Ellis has made it clear before that he doesn't believe that there is necessarily loyalty in rugby, and there are times where I think he's been pissed off with how Tigers have treated him, particularly in the past. Hopefully that's all water under the bridge now. But he is someone who looks at rugby as being, you know, this is my career, this is an investment. I'm an asset, and I will be traded. And he accepts that. And so the loyalty thing, I think he quite correctly perhaps calls out as being, you know, well, to an extent being bullshit. So we have to be aware of that. He's not someone who you're going to tug on the heartstrings too much of it. He's going to look at it in quite a cold manner to a degree. That said, he's still a passionate bloke. He is the club captain. And I think that as long as we are sensible and we make him the right offer, the fair offer, I don't think that there's going to be any other extra factors that are pulling him to Saracens, as it were, as there seem to be with Ford.
I agree with all of that. If we're good by him, he'll be good by us. And I think that's the sort of mantra that he works with. If you don't dick me around, and I won't dick you around. I think he's an honest bloke, and I think he's a good bloke. So yeah, I agree with all of that. I like to think it's bollocks. Let's wait and see. But, you know, there's a deal to be done with Genji to keep him here for the next 2 or 3 years. Let's make sure we get it done.
Yeah, Tigers legend in the making. Ellis, if you listen, I don't want to sound desperate, but please fucking stay, mate. I can't deal with Fordy and you going. That's two of the fan clubs I've signed up for just torn up in shreds straight away. Okay, so on to the Quins game. Elliot and I were just discussing, as in between segments, as you probably guessed, we record this in segments. We've said, Elliot said, Christ, we sound crap tonight, perhaps because it's so late. I'm also coming off the back of a horrible toddler-induced cold. Anyone who has a toddler knows that they pick up these super colds that really wipe you out. And we've realised that the voice is a little bit huskier, a little bit deeper, to the extent it's now sounding like a love-in radio host, isn't it?
Late Night Love with Mike and Elliot. It's not the ring. It's not the brand, is it? It's not the brand we wanted.
There was a guy in Sydney, when I lived in Sydney, called Richard Mercer. Texting. This isn't actually a Love Hour. He sent us a tweet or an email if you have actually been in Sydney and listened to Richard Mercer's Love Hour, as it was. I mean, the guy was just a legend. He'd be sat there saying, oh, I've got a message here from Lisa. Lisa says to Tom, she's sorry for the things she said, but she hopes you'll have her back in a heartbeat. Here's Barry White. And you're like, straight away, like, if you're Tom listening to that, you're like, whatever you say, Richard says it, I should forgive you. Fine, done. But let's move swiftly on from bad accents to good wins. And we will have a look about the win on Sunday against the reigning champions, Harlequins, coming to town. 2 points in it, 16-14. Fuck me, it was tense. I think it's fair to say that one could have gone either way.
Yeah, I mean, last week we said with the Quins boys, it would be a few points deciding it, and you did say that we'd be shitting it in the last 10. So between us, I think we've predicted what was going to happen. I think, to be fair, I think it was a great win for us. You know, as I put on Twitter after the game, that's Quins, Saris and Exeter all put away at home now. So that's, you know, that's a real statement.
And so...
Yeah, 100%. That's a great, great addition as well. So four strong teams all battered away at home. I think we shaded it. I'd been a bit disappointed if we hadn't won that, to be fair. I think we had the better moments over the game, and I think we were the better team overall. I think we, without really heading into our strides, it's a great game. I have to say, if you were neutral, you'd be watching that, getting your money's worth. Two teams really going at it without spilling over into the classic it could have been. But it was certainly a good one. And I think, yeah, I think for me, neither of us were in the huddle with Genji at the end, but I'm pretty sure he'll have been telling the boys that enjoy the win, great result, but we probably need to be a little bit better and a little bit sharper next week when we travel into
France. Yeah, a lot more clinical.
But I think the key point from it is, you know, when you actually think about it, the last time that full squad was together was the 23rd of October at home to Sale. You know, some of the internationals then went away for the Northampton game. Then a few more went away for the Bath game. And that's a month ago. So technically, the whole squad's not been together for 6-7 weeks. And a lot of boys haven't had a lot of rugby in 4 weeks. And the other blokes that have been playing rugby are either in a different Tigers team in the Prem Cup or away with England or their international side. So it was always probably going to be a bit rusty in our performance. And I suspect that's probably... in so many areas where we weren't quite as slick, that's probably the areas we'll probably be thinking on, I guess.
Possibly a little bit the same for Quins as well, if you think they've just brought Smith and Dombrandt back as well. I mean, I know that they had a week in the Premiership last year and they elected to rest them. But still, it's the same thing. If you think how important those guys are to how they play, and they were both good, albeit we'll talk about, we think, Ford having the better of Smith again. But they were both good again, and they're so important to how they play. So again, perhaps there's a bit of rustiness there. But actually, I think when we were talking with the Quins boys about it, and they're really knowledgeable about Quins, and they made some really good points, and we had a very respectful debate on how the game was going to go. We both agreed it was going to be pretty tight, and we pointed out, and we almost agreed where we thought the other would have the upper hand. And the one thing that was very different to how we thought, I thought both sides really negated the other's strengths really well. We're going to come on to it later. I thought they had the upper hand in the scrum. I thought they pretty well diffused our maul. Sometimes, you know, a bit naughtily, but didn't get caught up. But you do what you can. And I thought they got away with that well. I thought that Quins' MO is getting to the outside of you repeatedly. I thought our cover was superb to the point where I think they only got round us once. And that wasn't even for their try. That was a phenomenal bit of play by Lino. We'll come to that later as well. But I thought this was a little bit of a feather in the cap in many ways for the coaches, for looking at the opposition's strengths and actually turning them against them. And I thought the areas where both sides thought they might get an upper hand and almost not take it for granted, but say, you know, yeah, we'll beat them in this facet, we'll beat them in that, actually didn't really come to pass. The only thing where I thought we did beat them was in the territorial kicking game. That's where Youngs and Ford were both excellent in particular. Let's go and have a look at that game anyway. And actually, I've just mentioned Ben Youngs. Did we just get the 2010 vintage back of Ben Youngs? You know, kind of electric sniping, but combined with that, you know, 2019 plus, you know, controlling presence that he's been. I thought that was the best game I've seen him had in Tiger shirt for ages. I know he wasn't man of the match. He should have been, in my view. I thought it was fucking fantastic.
I have to say, a few people do give him a bit of stick, old Youngsy. That's a two-fingered riposte if ever I saw it. I thought he was superb, like you did. I mean, he's up there for me as one of the best nines we've ever had. And his performance on, yesterday, on Sunday, was absolutely superb. I mean, the break from the line-out, if it included defend to Smith, if ever that deserved a try, it was just brilliant. I mean, it really was.
There was a lot to it. I tell you what, I remember him setting up a try at home against the Ospreys in Europe, where exactly the same. It's sort of like this big, elaborate dummy in the middle of a line-out that sends the tail gunners running one way. The front pod are locked in still because they were trying to win the ball. And he goes through the gap. Nice acceleration. He's still still got some decent gas on him. And not only that, then he obviously, like he said, puts a nice sit-down on Marcus Smith. And it was actually a really lovely handoff because he sort of gets him once and then with a secondary push, really pushes his face into the ground. You know, it's a tricky tackle for Smith, mate. I saw people saying, bad defence. Yeah, he is too high, but he's covering across and Youngs has got a step on him. So, you know, it's good attack as opposed to bad defence. And then what I like about it is it's ballsy. Like, he realises there isn't support there. He goes, I'm going to have to route one this. And you don't see many nines looking at a tough cookie like Tyrone Green, who I know isn't the biggest guy, but he's South African, which means he's hard. And secondly, he is a nuggety, tough player. And he properly Samoan sidesteps him. That's the advantage of the two Alagi brothers coming through. You do pick up one or two things. And he makes some really good yards in contact. And to be honest, actually, it's probably the one bit of crap decision-making Fordy had all game, was going to a point where there were no numbers and trying an overcooking a crossfield kick to Hanro, which actually, having said it was crap decision making, if it had nailed the crossfield kick and it was put it a bit on a lower trajectory, we could have been talking about a moment of genius. But I'll pull it back to Youngsy overall. But he had a couple of breaks, didn't he? And let's just quickly talk about that. He had one down the blind side off a scrum where he left Don Brandt behind, and then a really clever kick. And then that try at the start of the second half for Potter, who had another strong game as well, I have to say. But that was absolutely fantastic, wasn't it? I mean, the kick was just genius. His skill set is so underrated, I think.
What I liked about that is because it was the combination of Youngs and Ford, where I need to probably look back at the replay of it again. I'm pretty sure it's Youngs telling Ford to not kick it and draw the defence out, tell him where the space is. And that's a great bit of interaction between the two of them because it brings out the defender, allows Ford to drag him out, pop it, give it, and it then sets it off. And Youngs has still got the gas to get on the outside down the line. And it's brilliant, again, communication. And then execution. It's one thing to see the space with your teammates' help. It's then a different thing to then execute the kick on the run to absolute pinpoint perfection for Potter to run in and score. Get that too long, no try. Get that too short, tackle short.
The angle as well, though, the angle. He puts it at a place where only Potter can get to it.
Yeah. It is pinpoint brilliance, and it was a fantastic try for lots of different reasons. But I thought it was, coming back to the Youngsy thing, I think his experience and his talent and his wherewithal with Ford wins us that game. And the only thing I'd say, it's the first time in a while I'm actually a bit disappointed with Borthwick, because I'd like to see him go out for another 5-10 minutes. Yeah. You know, I love Wigglesworth. I thought we maybe had jumped the gun a little bit on bringing Youngs off.
Actually Youngsy was really taking the game by the scruff of the neck. I thought, just on that point about the communication, you're right, it was. And I watched this back, and it's actually a nice little bit of acting as well by Youngsy, because he's stood as Ford's returning the kick. Youngsy stood in that 5 meter channel by the touchline, and he's got his back to Liner. Liner can't see what he's saying, but you can see Youngsy is gesticulating sort of subtly. You can't see me if you're listening to this, but he's got, there's a lot of stuff with the eyes and subtle stuff with the hands, and he's talking, and Fordy's talking as well. And Youngsy doesn't look interested. He's sort of just, you know, ambling around. He's no threat. He's not going to cause you any damage, Harlequins. Don't you worry about him. And Liner you know, because of that, he drifts out of Leiner's thought process. Leiner is looking at Ford. Ford's, hang on, he's running. Right, well, he's my man. I've got to hit him. And all of a sudden, about 2 meters before the contact point, Young's turn, sprints into action, gets a ball, pick up pace is good, and then the brilliant kick through. And lovely sport. You know, you've got to remember, Potter scored that on the left, and he's a right winger. Just goes to show that work rate and tracking of wingers that we've been talking about as well. But that was just fantastic communication between Ford and Young's, just like you said.
On that point, Charlie Morgan from the Telegraph, great journalist,
he did a
rather brilliant thing today, and it's worth watching on Potter because he tracked Potter's movements for that try, and it shows Potter's work rate and his fitness and all the work that the coaches do to an absolute T. Whilst that's going on, all of that comes from kick tennis that was going on for about a minute or two, constantly between Leicester and Quinns at the start of that second half. All of that's happening on the right, whilst going on, Potter's up and down the right wing. He's constantly going up and down, chasing the kicks as it comes back, going forward. He then moves across to the left-hand side of the pitch to join that kick and sprints through. So that's a 2 or 3 minute period of kick tennis, which is going side to side at full pelt, chasing the kicks. He then has the wherewithal and the fitness to get there at the end of Young's kick. That is a brilliant bit of wing play. It's absolutely superb. And if you have Twitter, follow Charlie Morgan, who did a brilliant graphic, who tracked it for those 2 or 3 minutes. And I cannot tell you how tough that is to do over a 2-3 minute period at full pace. So it's fantastic from Potter.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Let's just keep on Potter for a second, because it wasn't the only important involvement he had. He made a massive try-saving tackle on Hugh Jones. Jones possibly could have given it earlier. But
possibly.
But the thing is that he's got Stewart drifting off, so it doesn't look like he's got a two-man overlap. He's like, if I give this short, Stewart's going to hit the short man. Stewart could step up and get a man a ball. I could throw a miss pass straight to the guy on the outside, but then Stewart's still in a position because he was backing off to be able to accelerate and potentially affect an intercept. So it's really smart, subtle play by Stewart first. And yeah, Jones, I think, should have perhaps it's his first start in the Premiership's first game back for a while. Maybe it's a lack of confidence and sharpness by him. He's a quality player, and usually I'd expect someone like him to be able to pull that off. But whilst he's thinking, you've then got Potter coming across, sort of blindsiding him. He doesn't know he's there. He hits him, he rolls him, and it's just a brilliant bit of communication between, so I've said communication really intensely like twice in the last 2 minutes, but it's a really good bit of communication between Potter and Stewart.
It's called my bluff, isn't it?
That's exactly it. And Stewart's basically doing the more subtle thing, perhaps, of stepping off and making Jones make a very difficult decision. And what he wants Jones to do is to hang on to the ball, because he's saying, I could ruin any of your options if you pass it. And whilst he's doing that, whilst he's thinking, you've got to think there's about 1,000 different things going on at once. He's got Potter sweeping in from the side, affecting a brilliant tackle, bloody close to being another high one. But luckily, I think Ben Kay explained on BT Sport, didn't he, that actually the seatbelt tackle rule, not quite as strict as it was last year. It actually has to still be contact with the head, so you can get away with an over-the-shoulder one now.
Yeah, I think it's unbelievable defence. My gut feel is that Jones had a better opportunity to throw the pass, but that's almost academic. I mean, but in terms of the skill level, it's brilliant defence and power and just all-round heart and commitment to nail it like that and to do it. And what it did is galvanised us, and it almost, you took the heart away a bit from Quinns, because you could see as soon as it was given as a held up, the crowd went absolutely ballistic. And it just gave everyone such a lift, especially we've been under the pump a little bit for those couple of minutes. It meant we could go in, tails up, and it was deflated Quinns a little bit. And you could see in the two teams as they walked off what it meant to both sides and what a moment it was. And it was just a superb, again, evidence of character, commitment, and say what you want about these Tigers players. They've got heart, they've got commitment. We've spoken all season on this podcast about these sort of moments of try-saving tackles. And this is just another example of boys putting their heart on the line. So, you know, and it just shows the impact of having the likes of Aladdin and Super Kev in the background doing it, because without those two, those tackles don't happen.
That's right. And that was happening when both sides were down to 14 men. Marcus Smith was yellow carded for Quinns. We'll come to that in just a second. Jasper was yellow carded for us, his mandatory yellow card. I thought this was unlucky. And I think if you listen to the TMO, the TMO says penalty only. And then we've got Tempest wanting to even things out, having just yellow carded Smith and look it straight away. Look, that kind of tackle, unfortunately, happens a bit too much. And it's a guy going too low. He's still trying to wrap his arms. It's a bit clumsy. It is not dangerous by any stretch of the imagination. And this was well overly officious, in my view. I think that Jasper's been carded on rep there. But this is the problem that he's got now. He has to be whiter than white.
For me, what it's a penalty because it technically there is no arms. But he's
it's definitely a penalty. I've no qualms with the penalty whatsoever.
If it's dangerous play, what's it dangerous to his ankle? The whole point of the tackle regulations now is to tackle low. Is if you know what Tempest is saying is we want people to not tackle high, but we don't want them to tackle low. Well, what do you want? You know, this is the nonsense of giving him a yellow card in there. Is that if you're trying to do learnt behaviour here to try and get people to learn their ways? Well, what lesson are you trying to get him to do here? And you know, I don't want to slag referees off, and I don't want to bag them. It's not it's a tough gig, but Tempest is shit. I'm not.
Tell us what you really think, Elliot.
Yeah, I know, but I'm not being funny. But Tempest is up there one of the worst referees in the game for me, and I don't really get happy saying it. And it's decisions like that which make a nonsense of it, where you have a TMO who's quite, in this instance, correct, saying, you know, it's a penalty, it's not dangerous. Fair enough, Tempest is referee, it's his name on the chopper, and he makes it a call. But it's the wrong call. And it's stuff like that where I think it's harsh. It was harsh when the BT boys were saying, I think that wasn't a yellow. So
yeah. And we all know Ben Kay loves to go against Leicester with these things as well. He's really anti-Leicester. But look, I mean, the thing, refereeing is a really tough gig and everyone has bad days. Look at Luke Pearce the other day. I mean, he was awful against Exeter and Saracens. Evenly awful, I would say. And I did think Tempest had a bad game and he was evenly bad. My thing with Tempest is that I think that his manner isn't authoritative. He looks stressed and it feels stressed, and that doesn't create a particularly smooth playing environment. And then also he happens to look like a retired divorced music teacher, which I don't think like lends him that natural air of authority, if I'm being honest. But look, he had yellow carded Smith for off the ball, smacking the ball out of the hands, you know, pick one. But that came from a really good carry from Dan Kelly. And just before we move on to the Smith v Ford battle, Dan Kelly had a quietly excellent game again. That was a very dominant carry where he just basically looked at Smith and said, I'm going through you. And he fucking did. And not only that, he also picked some brilliant turnovers again. He dealt with Esterhuizen very well, who is a superb player. I've got a lot of time for Esterhuizen, but Kelly marshalled him really well. I think it's another step forward in him becoming a very, very fine inside centre for Tigers.
You cannot disagree with any of that. He was superb again. We don't normally talk about his attacking stuff because his defensive work's so good, and that's where we probably see him come to the fore quite a bit. But that carry, if he adds in some strong carries to his game, he is turning into an all-round centre because, you know, like you say, that's a superb carry, got us over the grain line. And it's not just the number of turnovers, the effect. That one right at the end was a crucial turnover in the context of the game. You know, without that, we're probably on the rack a little bit. We were wobbling slightly. And Quinns were charging. You know, he had to make that turnover, and he did, and at a crucial time in the game. And he timed it perfectly. Do you know what I mean? He spotted the opportunity, stuck out the tackle a little bit, didn't rush into the ruck. When he saw his opportunity, got in, nailed it. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And to be, you know, Eddie Jones would have probably been looking at that. And you know what? You can't do much wrong by getting him into the Six Nations team. If you wanted an outside bet for an inside centre, I don't think you can go wrong with picking Dan Kelly because he is brilliant.
Selfishly, I hope not, because we obviously want him to stay caveats. Here. No, exactly.
Normal caveats involved of, no, Eddie, leave him here.
Don't pick him, Eddie. Exactly. Yeah. Let's have a look at the Ford v Smith battle. It didn't get going like we wanted it to. I think conditions played a part, but also good coaching, as we pointed out before. I think that
good
meant
defense.
That
good
defense from both teams as well was really good at shutting down options. So we didn't see a huge amount from either 10 with the ball in hand. Smith's slap I got was a little bit of frustration. I think he was annoyed he'd lost that contact. He'd been done over by Ben Youngs earlier. He wasn't getting the space he wanted. I don't think Smith had a bad game. I need to put that out there. And to me, he is still the first choice England 10. I really do. But if you want to see the bits that he can learn from someone like Ford, this was a game for it. The game for me was swung a lot of the time because we won that territory battle. We pushed them to a point where they'd have to run it from deep. And that was largely Ford v. Smith. Ford's kicks generally being more on the money than Smith. And I think actually by the end, we stopped seeing Smith kicking it so much because he wasn't being accurate enough. That for me is still an area of his game that he needs to work from. And this is where, again, I will bang on about it. Eddie Jones is mad not having Ford in the squad, at least, even if you're going to have him in your match day 23. Just so that he can share some ideas with Smith, because Smith could be a perfect all-round 10, but this is an area of his game, I think, the more boring side of the game. It's less Quincy, much less Quincy, but I think that it's an area of the game I think he could really benefit from learning from Ford from.
I agree. I agree with that. I think if you're to take it in isolation, I think Smith had a good game. You know, he played all right. He certainly didn't have a bad game.
No, with the limited chances he got, and there was an absolutely outrageous dummy switch there that I think had half the terrorist looking the opposite way, and it was pretty nice.
I mean, that was filth. The thing with Smith is that it's hard to judge him on yesterday's performances because our defence was so good, and that we shackled him and that back line really, really well. And it meant that the normal opportunities that Smith gets and the gaps and the spaces that he exploits so well just weren't there. So effectively, he was having to work on a normal, you know, normal game. And he's having to try and almost create something out of nothing. And shout out to our defence coach, Kev Sinfield, again, because we read all the little dummy plays and the pods and the fakes and all the rest of it. We were absolutely superb at. I think the difference between Ford and Smith is an age thing. And that comes from playing 150, 200 more games in Ford's favour.
Half of them behind a crap pack like Ford has had to do recently,
100%, because if you look at this, it's a 7-8 year age gap. Those sort of subtle things which you've just mentioned, the ugly side of the game management and stuff like that, that comes with playing 200 senior games at top level rugby for club, country and all the rest of it. And you only get those by being put in those instances and you're thrown into it and you're having to learn it. And I think, like you said, those are subtle things that Smith doesn't have yet because he's not played enough. He's got all the talent in the world, but game management and subtleties and just dropping a kick in behind or nudge it. Like there was one moment with 6 or 7 minutes to play. Ford just gets the ball, grubs it through into 22, boxes Quinn's back in there. And it's a subtle kick. It's not going to go down in the pantheon of great kicks, but in the game management, the context of where we are, that is superb game management. And it's just so easy to do and knock it in. And the only other thing I'd say about Fordy, oh my God, he was ambitious on touch finders.
Well, there was a couple those in front of us, weren't they? Yeah.
Absolutely superb. Well, I was thinking, oh my God, he's fucked it. And he nailed it. And so there's little things like that. I think Ford edged it. And I think that just comes with experience and knowing his game and having played at the top level for a bit longer. So, but again, two good tens that we've got to see. We didn't really get to, it's a shame really, but the defences were so good. We didn't really get to see the either 10 pull the strings open, but you know.
Exactly.
And it was never going to be that game, was it?
No, exactly. I still think we'd have had a 2 points difference either way if the weather had been really sunny. And I think we'd have seen perhaps, you know, a real good exhibition of the kind of rugby both sides can play. Because I think both sides are playing good rugby. Quinn's is more expansive and, you know, easy on the eye, but ours is pretty brutal and nice to watch if you're into that kind of thing as well. But look, let's have a look at the game management side again, because one thing that perhaps didn't go quite to plan was the scrum. And Genji, on paper, I thought would have had the nudge over Will Collier. In fact, I'm pretty sure I've seen him have the nudge over him before. And then you've also got a big scrummager in Montoya up against Walker, who is a very decent player, really great Walker. But perhaps he is not as big and physical as Montoya. And then you've got Cole against Marler. And Cole has got the upper hand against Marler before. Marler before said, I don't particularly enjoy scrummaging against Danny. He always seems to do me. And yet, we seem to be going backwards. Actually, I think Quinn's made a few mistakes where they took the ball out of the scrum a little bit early. And I thought, lads, hold it in there. Maybe they're not used to kind of like, they weren't expecting it. But I thought if they held it in there, they could have been getting more penalties out of us and really putting us under pressure. But you say that you're not worried about that scrum. Why is that?
It's not. I have a theory, and I want to road test it on you and see what you think. I think we have sacrificed scrum dominance in order to boost up the overall game plan that we play by. If you think back to 2 years ago when we were 11th and dog shit, we had a dominant scrum, but we had nothing else. Fundamentally, our whole game plan under Borthwick now is dynamic. That's the buzzword. It's dynamic ball carrying. When the forwards hit the line with a carry, they hit it at speed and they're dynamic. In defence, They offer line quickly. It's dynamic. They're hitting the attacking line at speed, getting back off the line quickly. When we kick chase, it's dynamic. Just, you know, we come up in a line, including Dan Cole is leading the charge. You know, and we're expected to do that.
And he does look leaner than he's done in previous years as well. Yeah,
he does. And we're expected to do that for 80 minutes. I think in order to be able to do all of those things, you can't accuse our pack of being understrength. You cannot accuse our pack of being weak. You cannot accuse our pack of not being up for it. We have the best pack in the league for me. I'll keep muttering that. But there's a difference between having a really strong, gnarly pack and scrum time, because that's a different sort of power, because that's one-off pushing almost. And I don't think you can play the game plan, which is high intensity, high dynamism, and all the rest of it comes with it for 80 minutes, like we do, and still have set piece dominance, because that's a different kind of power. And I think we've sacrificed the scrum dominance a little bit to just have a scrum that works. We're not after, if we get penalties, great. But I don't think that's the be all and end all, because technically, how many scrums do you get in a game? 5, 6?
Yeah, there'll be some stats behind it, won't there, as well?
There's probably, let's say, in the most in the game, there's about 8, maybe double. You might get to double figures, but it's very rare that you get that. Whereas the overall game plan of what we play, of dynamism, that's going to be more often. And that's the imperative that we do. So my theory that I put to you is that I think we have sacrificed scrum dominance for a scrum that does well without being dominant, at the expense of making sure that our overall game plan is pucker, that allows us to do all the things that we've been really good at. I think on Sunday, they've just got the nudge on us.
That sounds like a sound theory. I don't know. I'm greedy. I think you can have both. And I don't know, like, obviously we've coincided perhaps with the loss of Boris, maybe some adjustment to some new methods as well. That's always going to take a little bit of getting used to. We then need to have a look at, you know, potentially the changes in the pack. We had a last minute change, of course, where Callum Green comes in for Snyman. And look, Green was great player, and he got a really key line out steal, didn't he? Pretty much right in front of me on the terrace. Absolutely fantastic. Red Walker's thrown like a book. But he is not a big second row by modern second row standards. And you lose a hell of a lot of pushing power, I think, if you don't have someone like Snyman in there. Now, I was listening to Joe Marler and Dan Cole on their Joe Marler Show podcast a while ago. It was after one of the Autumn Internationals, the South Africa one. And Thomas Lavanini came up because he got another yellow or red card, beg your pardon, for Argentina. And they asked Coley about him. He said, I've got a lot of time for Thomas. You've got to remember that he came over, didn't speak a word of English. He said, I think the first thing he learned was, come on, Coley, before every scrum. He said he'd be smacking him on the shoulder. He's like this 6'8" Argentinian smashing him on the shoulder, and Coley was turning around, can you stop doing that? Really hurts. But by the way, he said, look, this guy was like a fucking traction engine. Like, you'd bend down, like sometimes he said, I wouldn't quite nail the engagement, or I'd say, go on, he's in a better position than me here for Lucy. But then all of a sudden you hear this from behind you, and it's just Thomas Labadini plowing through, basically carrying the scrum forward. And I remember hearing the same, I think, from both Castor and Coley about Lewis Deacon as well, perhaps another underrated player. So I think that engine room, and we've talked about it before, you know, do we want a really, really big beast second round? Perhaps that's what Snyman's there, sort of to try and fill that role. That also has a difference, particularly if you've been training all week with him, with the idea of having him there. And then you've got Callum Green there, fine player, different strengths, and perhaps that takes him getting used to as well. But look, we could talk about scrums all day. Let's go and quickly finish off. I'm just going to quickly, we have to give a good shout out to that Lewis Liner try as well. I thought that was a fantastic bit of play. I thought that it was as good as Harry Potter's try. Apparently the neutrals thought it was better because that got put in the try of the week competition and Potter's didn't. But I remember people around me cheered when he kicked it because it looked like he'd sliced it and it bounced in. So maybe there was a bit of luck there, but Christ, that guy's a quality winger, isn't he?
He's got pure gas, hasn't he? That's some gas to get that.
I don't know if he's got pure gas. I think he's got good gas, but I think he's just smart in how he uses it. And he, tell you what, he kept Nemani pretty quiet again.
He did. What I found, what I liked about the try as an ex-winger is that Nemani absolutely shoved, gave him a proper shove off the pitch, but he manages to keep his feet and just pegs it down the line and gets there. And it's a good, really tidy finish. It was almost out of nothing. It was the first sort of half chance maybe where Smith could opened his arms up a little bit and lobbed a really, really nice pass. Just fizzed it across into Lainer's hands. It's a good kick, good pace to get there. It's a really, you know, it's one of those where you go fair play to you because that's an awesome bit of skill.
Yeah, everyone around us started doing that. We started, yeah, you can't moan about that. Fantastic bit of individual brilliance.
And I don't think you can knock the defence or the defence coach for that one because you just go, you know what, that's really good attacking play. Fair play to you because, you know what, that's, like you said, the kick in itself is difficult to execute, let alone if...
Well, they didn't get around the outside of us with that. That was effectively... In fact, Lainer was marked up 2-1, which made it all the more special. So absolutely fair play to him. And it led to a real shit-your-pants finish, again, where we connive to lose one of our lineouts, concede a penalty. Then thankfully they lost the lineouts as well, just to even out. But look, very little between the teams. The stats show there was very little between the teams as well. Already looking forward to the return fixture, and hopefully we can get the Quins boys to buy us a beer.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Okay, make sure your parachute is securely fastened as we leap out of the plane and plummet towards Elliot's Cult Corner. The number 10 shirt, mate, the likely lads. Who's the glory boy? Who's it going to be? It's been an absolute walkover, hasn't it?
What do you mean? It was the closest one of them all. Of all the positions we've done, it's such a close one. No, I tell lies.
Well, it was to get the public voted there, wasn't it?
Well, 100%. I mean, Ian Humphries and Jeremy Staunton with neck and neck in the semi-final at 39% each. I couldn't think of a fair way of trying to sort it. And I also was having a few beers at the time. So laziness kicked in. I just went, oh, fuck it, both can go in, which I think is fair. So we'll say fairness wins. So Jaco van der Westerhaizen, 68%, absolute runaway. I thought it was always going to be...
Yeah, Jaco was always going to win.
Favourite. As soon as I typed up the four, there was no betting market on this one because it's literally, yeah, he's going to win. Do you know what I mean? He got 68%. Humphreys got 13, Staunton got 11, and Berkey got 8. I mean, it's a walkover.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, Jaco was just quality, wasn't he? Only played for half a season before he fucks off to Japan. So that just gave him that mystique as well.
I think he had all the aspects for Colts, I think. It was brilliant, wasn't here long enough, and then fucked off.
Yeah, love it. Excellent. Well, let's move on to inside centre. It's been a harder selection this time, hasn't it? We seem to, again, we've had like the Anthony Allen era and stuff. And then actually we've churned through a lot of 12s as well. So it's been a harder task to select one.
This has been pretty tough because we've had a lot of quality, a lot of long-standing 12s who don't meet the criteria. So picking people that do meet the criteria has been tough.
Let's quickly list the people who are out. So Howard, out. Allen, out. Major, Kafer. Out. Kafer, shit. So out. He was shit for
Gibson.
Us, yeah. Gibson's too good.
Too good. You know, this is the problems we're having to face here. This is genuine first world problems. You can't run a podcast segment when you've got these problems. However, we've got three names for you, which we're going to throw out. And we've got one for each of us, which actually works out quite nicely.
So yeah, although we're not going to split. Are we going to split who's who? Because effectively, you and I both had the ones that the public had. And then we're just going to throw in this third one just as a bit because we think everyone's forgotten about him, but he was mint.
Yeah, so the two that we both chose were Ayula Erinley and the man himself, 36, Billy 12 Trees.
Yeah. Yeah, so Erinley obviously had that. We bought him from WAS when he was a sensation. Well, he was a sensation. Then he sort of fell off the radar a bit at WAS when we came along and he was going to be a bit part player. And he very much came into the fray when Sam Vesey was doing his best Dan Carter impression at 10. And that was largely due to the fact he had this moving house next to him, which was Erinley. And he kept making yards. He didn't half run hard. Very, very simple stuff. He even got an England cap, I think, at the end of it. So fair play to the guy. He was tough as nails. And I think somebody pointed out he even is a countdown champion. So if you're going to go for cult status, that's it, surely.
It is hard to argue with all of that. Like you say, he was mustered at WASP. I think him and Paul Sackey formed an unbelievable combination for WASP in that sort of their golden era. And like you say, in that period of time, remember when we beat Bristol like 92-3? I think we really had a hand in like 50 points. For all the tries,
he was a machine.
Up. So, yeah, we got a Rindley. 36, it comes down to a classic debut at home to Ospreys, where this lad with, like, hair all over the place, no one's ever heard of, takes the field, and just runs everyone ragged. And it's just like, oh my God.
Squidge Rugby compared him to the sort of the English James Hook, which is probably not a bad shout, you know. But that's the thing with us, wasn't it? All the time, it was always like, oh, it's going to be Billy 12 Trees at 12, Mano at 13. That's a dream. And he just never quite kicked on. I think what gives him cult status was he was never first choice, but he always had the promise of being the Messiah.
Next season will be his year.
And he had, but he had quality moments, a great player, and with a great nickname of 36.
12 trees, 36.
So you've got a lot of time for that. So that's brilliant. But I'm going to throw in the third one, which I threw to you just beforehand, which is Seremiah Bye. Now, I know a lot of you will be like, well, why him? But he came along when he was about 38, last 2 years of his career. And he came on when the team was struggling a wee bit, but he didn't half play well. He played hard, quality operator, played for us for two seasons, Fiji international, scored three tries, I think, for us. Just looked classy and composed, and was one of the few players I tried to start a song about, going, bye, bye, Seremiah, bye. And that's as far as I got. And then, as usual, people in the terrace started frowning at me. But, you know, if somebody wants to finish it off, carry on.
I'm offended on your behalf because that had the potential for being mustard. I'm not gonna lie, that could have been a one.
Yeah, exactly. So those are the three.
Yeah, so Rinley, 36, bye.
All right, well, let's look forward again to this weekend. We're joining the European top table at long last. Feels like a long time. Are we fancying ourselves a feast? Are we gorging ourselves this weekend at the top table?
The only things I'm gorging myself on this weekend is cheese and meat.
And a glass of Bordeaux, perhaps.
Whoa, I love that segue. Yes, we do play Bordeaux in France. I mean, what a game. To go from Quins at home, champions, Premiership winners, to then go back into Europe, Bordeaux, top of the French league, smashing it. It's like, oh my God. It's good though. This is what it's all about.
This is exactly it. And you and I, neither of us watch a lot of top 14. I think we sort of keep abreast of the headlines. And whenever we think of good French teams, we think of some of the big names, whether it historically or in recent times. So you're looking at Toulouse, Montpellier, La Rochelle, Racing, and even, you know, they're not much cop anymore, but Toulon and Stade Francais, still serious size. Clermont Auvergne, I think I said earlier, the best side to never win the European Championship. These are all quality sides. You don't necessarily think of the Bordeaux Beagles or Bagels. Either way, you know, nice dog or delicious treat. It's not what I would necessarily name a rugby club after, but they are fucking smashing the top 14, played 12, won 9, lost only 2. And one of those was on the first game of the season where everyone's a bit ropey. And the thing is with the top 14, it has historically always remained the same, that teams generally win their home games. So you actually have quite a condensed table with teams losing a fair few games, sometimes against surprising sides. Bordeaux haven't shown that. They've shown a really good consistency across the board. They're going to be a hell of a challenge away from home.
I mean, it's going to be a fascinating game. We're going to be put to the test. I mean, we said all season, especially on this podcast, is that each week Tigers have been tested in different ways. And so far, domestically, they've found different ways of winning. They've stood up to the test and they've come through it. This is going to be up there as being one of the biggest tests. It's not just the on-field stuff. It's the off-field stuff. The atmosphere, the noise, the partisan of the French fans. Having to travel to France, you know, that's a thing, because it's a different routine. It's going to be brutal. I'm really excited for it. Who knows how it's going to go? I think I heard when I was driving home from Sunday's game, Chris Edgerton on Radio Leicester said this, it would be up there as one of, if Leicester did win, it would be go down as Leicester's greatest ever European wins outside the finals. I slightly disagree with that, because I think winning away in Munster in 07 would have been the bigger thing. But I can understand where he's coming from, because this is huge. Because like you say, Bordeaux on four. They look, this is going to be mega.
If you go through their team, you start to very quickly realise why they're not doing too badly, actually. I'm just going to throw some
numbers. Who we got?
Let's go into the front row first, where you have the excellent Jefferson Poirot. He's not related to the detective, but he is a superb prop for France, international prop, and he's their captain. And he's joined by the not so tiny Ben Tamafuna. Remember him? That huge guy. I think he played for the Chiefs in Super Rugby in New Zealand.
Big old boy.
And he played for Racing. I do remember Manu dump tackling him, the only man I've ever seen take him off his feet. Yeah, he is a big unit. He can be done, though. He can be done. You then have a look in their back row. Louis Piquemont is still knocking about for them, which is surprising. But Cameron Wokey, my God, that guy, if you've seen him for France, he is the next coming thing. He's sort of like a Tom Crofts-esque player. He's the real deal. He can play in the second row if needs be, but as a six, he's going to cause some real damage. You can't let him get the ball in space. Going into their back line, firstly, I like the fact that Tranduc is also still knocking about for them, who's the most French.
That's a great name.
Yeah, Francois Tranduc, but he was also the most hot and cold French player. There were times when he looked world class, wasn't there? There were other times he just didn't look interested. But their main man is Mathieu Jalibert, who obviously is sometimes first choice for France. Sometimes he's sort of pushed aside so that Untermat can play. Not a bad option to have, but Jalibert for me, I think it's just a wonderfully talented electric player. It's going to be really good seeing him go up against George Ford. And then actually in the backs, they've got some real quality out there. But the guy that stands out for me, Santiago Cordero, obviously ex-Chiefs player, Argentinian wizard on the wing, one of the best steppers in the world, probably alongside Tolisso Vaiano. I remember Cordero and I remember getting really annoyed because I spotted him in the under 20 World Cup, like back in 2014 or something like that. And I think I even sent in an email to the Tigers saying, you got to sign this guy whilst he's cheap. I was roundly ignored. It was probably in the Matt O'Connor era or Cockers was ignoring me or something like that. But I mean, that guy's superb. I mean, I'm listening to that. Am I getting you nervous yet?
It's going to be, I think this is the toughest test. And I think this is a really good indication of where we are. Fundamentally, to progress through to the next stage of the European competition, you're probably going to have to win both your home games and nick an away win from either Bordeaux or Connacht somewhere. I have a sneaky suspicion Steve's probably going to fancy Connacht. With all great respect to both teams, he's probably going to fancy Connacht away a little bit more than Bordeaux, because that's going to be an unreal test. What I would say is that our fitness may come in handy, because you mentioned about all these French teams, it's a lot about power and all the rest of it. If we can just stay in the fight, as we have shown over the course of the season, if we can stay in the fight for 70 minutes and be there or thereabouts with 10 minutes to go, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that A, we might find a line out and nick it and get over the line for maybe a win, or we get ourselves a losing bonus point or whatever else. And I think that's the thing where you've got to come out of is, let's see what the performance looks like. Let's see how the young lads, we've got a lot of young lads, especially, you know, in the round of 23, how are they going to cope in, this is a learning curve for them. They've gone away to Gloucester. That's one set of challenge. They're now got to go away down to Bordeaux. It's another different challenge. Let's see how they get on. And even if we don't get a result that we wanted, I'm actually quite interested in the performance more than anything, almost like Steve does. And I think if we can put some signs of a good performance together, that would be more interesting to me than the actual results.
Yeah, I agree to an extent. I think that how we're playing at the moment and the runs that we've put together in the Premiership Cup shows that this is a team that now expects to win and is wanting to win every trophy that they're competing for.
It finds a way to win.
Exactly.
Finds a way to win as well.
And so what is going to interest me is obviously more what's going to interest me is our own performance and our own selection and how we approach it. But it will be interesting to see how Bordeaux approach it, because you have to think traditionally, a lot of these French teams, they often don't translate their domestic form to the European stage. And sometimes that is because they've set themselves out at the start of the year. Top 14 is an incredibly attritional league. It's even more attritional than the Premiership. It's more physical. It's a bit slower, but they play more games. There's more teams. So it's going to be really interesting to see whether or not Bordeaux look at this and say, do you know what, actually, we're top of the league. We've got a chance of making some history here and, you know, getting ourselves a league title. I'm not that fussed about this Heineken Cup where, you know, we might not get it. So, and I remember that I've seen French teams do that before. I've seen French teams, I think it was Bourg-Once, who were flying in the top 14 unexpectedly a few years ago. And they sent this side over. We were all quaking in our boots to see what would happen. And Lewis Moody ended up scoring a hat trick against them. It was absolutely bizarre. So it'll be interesting how they approach it.
Are you thinking they might look at it and go, would rather take the domestic stuff and not be interested? That's a great point. I hadn't thought of that.
No, I don't know enough about them, and obviously kind of what their mentality is at the club. It could just be, though, if you've got guys who are carrying knocks, etc., and you think, well, hang on, this is a perfect opportunity to actually give these guys some rest that they would never get usually. And maybe it is an option for them. I don't know. But, Elliot, do you know anything at all about the bizarre setup of the European Cup this time?
Mate, if you can work out what's going on, please do let me know. And the same with anyone listening. If you can work out what the fuck's going on, please tell me. And you can tell it's ropey, because the BBC for the fixtures on Saturday just put pool question mark, because they don't know what's going on. No one does. It is an enigma. All we have to do, we're going to have to win every game, because that's the only way I can understand that we actually qualify to something, because I don't know how you qualify otherwise. So you're going to have to win every game.
So I don't like the way it's set up, because effectively all the teams are drawn into two pools and you play four games against two teams. But teams are allocated to the pools because they're put into four pots, you know, tier one, tier two, tier three, tier four. Yeah. And I don't know, we'll probably be tier three or tier four after, you know, shenanigans. But yeah, we're in there. And that means that you're not playing a team from every tier. It means that it's not an even distribution of fixtures. So you're not going to be comparing like with like you are. I mean, remember the old, I mean, I know it wasn't ideal, but you had six pools.
Pots of four, wasn't it?
Six pots of four. And then you had the two best losers as well, kind of going out from that as well. So it was all reasonably clear, apart from, you know, the best losers. And actually that was always added to some quite exciting permutations.
Yes, because it was always doing that, wasn't it? It was always changing. You could always see the tables changing as the games were played.
Yeah, and that was always like that live sort of Sky Sports thing. You said, no, they've scored a try. They've got a bonus point. That means that you've now got to do this. And that was always really exciting. This is a little bit more convoluted, that you can't sort of keep track of it whilst you're going on. It looks like you've basically got to step back after each round and say, Christ, we're in this against another 11 teams in our pool or whatever it is. And you have to step back and have a look to see, right, well, who's done what against what different teams. And you're not going to be able to nick points off them because you're not playing them. So it kind of takes a lot of the rivalry away. I know that this was kind of a bit of a stopgap, which I understand for COVID. I hope they don't stick with it in the long term, because it is not going to be a particularly attractive scenario, I don't think. That said, I mean, sound is that they're going to be bringing in South African teams, which I don't necessarily agree with. It's the European Cup, for fuck's sake. It's not the Rainbow European Cup or whatever, inheriting what the URC is. I know that they've got their rules, but it's the European Cup. It has to stay continental, in my view. But the more clubs you're going to throw into it, the harder it's going to become to create a tangible product. But anyway, look, that's enough about that. That can count as my moan for this week. What team are you putting out, mate? I'm going full bore. Would you do the same?
I would not make many or if any changes from Sunday's game. If everyone's fit from Sunday just gone, you'd maybe bring in Snyman, maybe. That's actually like you coming back to your earlier
argument. That's a size point again, because this is a game, one of the few games where we could get done by size and physicality.
I would suspect you'd just go same again with your starting lineup. If everyone's fit, ready to go, there's maybe an argument, I guess, to maybe bring Sal Mackie in just because of his size. There's maybe an argument to try and boost it that way, but I don't think it gets you anymore. The only other thing I would mention is Hanro did go off a bit early on Sunday's game. He looked like he was holding his shoulder. So, you know what? There may be a case for George Martin coming in. Ollie Chesham is an absolute unit, as we know. Yeah, you've got to go full bore, haven't you? I don't think there's any measure in not doing anything else.
No, exactly. We'll keep it nice and quick then on the team selection, because I'd effectively go for the same, perhaps Snyman ahead of Green. I'd still probably keep Chesham on the bench. I think he offers a bit more of an impact, and I'd start Martin ahead of Hanro if Hanro's struggling. Just on Martin and Chesham, I don't think Chesham has leapfrogged Martin in the pecking order at all, you know, for example, if at six. I think Chesham's there because he offers perhaps better cover and you know, better line-out presence, perhaps just because he's, you know, the tallest man in the world. Do you think that it's a case that he just offers a better second row cover and six cover than perhaps Martin does at the moment, who's more of a six? Or do you think he's leapfrogged him?
I don't think there is a general sense of leapfrogging. I suspect there might be Chesham at the moment is in the mood. So if he's on a hot streak of form, you just keep him going. And I suspect there might be something in that. He's got a bit of rhythm. But whilst he's in that rhythm, you keep him going. You know, that goes back years in professional sport where players just come through on a bit of a hot streak and you just keep on going because you want to take the advantage of it until they actually burn out, or, you know, you just have to take them out. So I think both are equally brilliant players. And I suspect they'll go with Chesham. But I don't think it's any sort of slight.
I think Martin will start at six. I think he would come straight in at start if Hannah is not there. Yes. But I tell you what, if you're going into this kind of game where it's going to be physical and you need someone to bang people, then George Martin is your man.
He absolutely folds people. And just remember, whilst we have a tough game this weekend, you could be a Bath fan. You have to go and play Leinster. And then a week later, play La Rochelle. So, you know,
do you know what? Cloud. I know we kind of like, we take the piss out of Bath a lot. I've always got a secret little soft spot for them. Maybe it's actually because it's a lovely, lovely city. And actually, despite the fact it's one of my first memories is seeing us lose when Neil Back pushed over Steve Lander, which was funny. I do have some very nice people, including my neighbour, who always, if I'm working late, always takes my bins out for me, despite being in his 70s. He's a Bath fan. Wow. So I do have some sympathy for them. We've been there. We can empathise with where they are. I don't want to see their noses rubbed in it too much. I hope we can all be respectful. But anyway, to the matter at hand, against Bordeaux, is this our first L of the season?
I suspect so. I'm going to go on the basis that Bordeaux put out a strong side and we fall up just short, but we take a losing bonus point with it. I think we get within 5 points of them. So Tigers to lose by five, but we put in a pretty decent performance.
You know, I probably agree with you, but I'm superstitious now because you've predicted us to lose before. I haven't. And I'm now convinced that if I predict us to lose, we're going to lose. So I'm going to say Tigers will nick it. I think we'll surprise them. I think that they will look at us as being a bit of a fluke this year, maybe not give us quite the respect we deserve.
Fair.
And we get out ahead and they can't claw it back and we win by 4 points. Tigers by four.
Mate, I think we'll all be cheering if you get that correct. I think we'll all be cheering.
You'll all be asking for my lottery numbers. Okay, that brings us just about to the end, mate. We thought this was going to be a quick sort of 30-minuter because we've started recording at 10. It's now 11:30. it has been interrupted by me having to do some dad work and put the toddler back to sleep, admittedly. But look, we're just about there. Do we have anything else to talk about before we log off and I try and edit this in the early hours?
Well, funny enough, we don't have much to moan about. We've actually got a lot of praise to give. And I think, you know, both of us have sort of said over the last couple of weeks that there's a lot of good things off the pitch at Tigers. And I think you've wanted to expand on a couple of those yourself.
Yeah. I'm going to get real with you people now. This is going back to the love hour vibe. I want to bring
late night love.
I want to bring it back down to the love. And I'm going to show some love for the club. Not just because they're playing so well and they're getting results. You know, that's all very nice. But actually, I don't think, looking back on it, I can remember a time, maybe in the response to the Matt Hampson incident, I don't think I can remember a time when I've actually been prouder of this club for the people that are involved, for the attitude from everyone involved. Even someone like George Ford, who, yeah, he's made his decision, but still gives 100%. And afterwards, he did a lap around the pitch and he raised his fist. You know, he wants it. I love that. But in particular, in relation to Sir Kev and his 101-mile run, Will Findlay, his half marathon challenge. I could do a half mile, but the half marathon challenge for 30 days. Both of those incredibly individually, but just a few moments on top of that, you know, Will joining Kev, you know, in the middle of the night, planning on only doing a small section of it, ends up running half of it with him just to stay with him. And there's just been a few incidences like that where you see the boys really fighting for each other. And I hope that the players realise that on the terraces, we feel that and we're behind that. And we feel part of that, even though, you know, we've got no right to feel part of what they put themselves through day in, day out, but we're fucking behind them. And yeah, I've been really proud of this club. And I hope everyone listens from the top down, Steve, Kev, the coaches, all the players, the comms staff.
Andrea
deserves a big shout out. She's done a superb bit of work there as well. She's been phenomenal. The comms at the club, Christ, we'll even have to compliment Bondi. It's been brilliant. Really, really proud to be a Leicester Tigers fan. And I don't think we could ask for any more than that at the moment.
Mate, hear, because it is absolutely top draw. And the great thing about the challenges is that everyone as a fan has bought into it. And, that, you know, we're living vicariously through it because all of us love the superhero stuff and none of us can do it. Let's be honest. That takes absolute unbelievable guts and determination to do what they're doing. It is absolutely fantastic. And it is brilliant when you see the video of Will on Monday or Tuesday last week, returning from his last day, doing that, not doing just a half marathon, he did a fucking marathon last day after doing 29 days.
Again, to push himself harder. And again, it goes with that Kev video where he says, I want it to be cold. I want it to be rain. I want to hurt. I want to suffer because I want to make sure I'm doing everything I can to support these guys.
I thought that was brilliant on his last day to do a marathon. And what I loved about it was the video of him coming back into Oval Park and all the players, all the coaching staff and everyone stopped what they were doing, gave him a guard of honour in and brought him in and got him over the line. I thought that was special and I thought that was brilliant. And I loved the video with Youngsy being at Oval Park and what he said about watching the Tigers makes me feel a bit emotional. Just talking about it here makes me feel emotional because it just shows that we're all in it. We're all in it with them. Even if we can't be on the pitch doing the stuff or doing the runs or whatever, that we are all in it together, like Will and Kev said. And it is absolutely fantastic. And it did make me feel a bit emotional watching Youngsy back at Oval Park and saying how proud he was of the boys. Yeah, I think that's brilliant. And like you said, everyone at the club off the pitch, on the pitch, they're getting all the plaudits. We all know what they're doing. But off the pitch, everyone involved, hands off, because you're absolutely smashing it as well.
It was a sellout against Harlequins, 24,000 post-COVID. That is remarkable. That is superb work across the board at a commercial level, communications, marketing. But if you're taking it down to its base level, the reason that people are coming back is not because we're winning. I mean, that does help. I'm sure it does help a little bit. But it's because the performances, the way players are fighting, and those incidences off the pitch, the way guys are fighting for each other. And that is what takes a club from being just a club you support to weaving itself within the fabric of the local society and your life as well. And yes, as I say, I think it's just absolutely phenomenal. Our only gripe, we have got one gripe, haven't we? Bondi, I know you're busy making the club look fucking great. I sent you an email about trying to get some players on. Sort it out, mate. Send them over. We wanted to talk to Coley today about we were hoping it would be after he marmalised Joe Marler, but instead it would be about how it was perhaps a trickier day at the office than expected. But Bondi, get back to us. Apart from that, you're all doing fantastically.
Yeah, absolutely smashing it, guys. Well done.
And we like the video, don't we, they put on now before, and they do like all the Leicester Tigers throughout the years. So it really gets you pumped up before a game.
100%. I'd be ready to charge onto the field at that. 100%. I thought it was mega.
Yeah, thank God for the club that neither of us did charge onto the field for it, because that would be a significant drop in quality. But hey-ho, look, that's us done for the week. We'll hopefully be with you next week, same time, and we will hopefully have a guest. I'm not going to name him yet, just because I need to confirm, but it should be a very good one. He has been mentioned in the podcast earlier, in case you wanted to do some digging. Ooh. And he is a good rugby brain, and he will have a lot of good insight for us. Until then, have a good week, everyone, and stay safe.
Cheers, guys.